You're listening to another top-rated radio show on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to the American Hour with your host, Commander Tom Garcia, on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Commander Tom Garcia on the USA Talk Radio Network, and we are broadcasting the American Hour here at 4 p.m. Eastern. Thanks for joining us. I have my lovely guest host, Paula Lozon Osman, with me, and we've already got our guest on the radio with us right now, Susan Bradford. We'll get to her in just a couple minutes, but we'll talk about a few things here, administrative things that we've got to get out of the way. Everybody knows we've got Winston Scott coming up on Friday, shuttle astronaut, and we're going to be talking about NASA, and more NASA for the whole hour, and we may even go a little bit over time because I know that's really important to a lot of people in Florida and a lot of people across the country, so don't miss that. He's a retired Navy captain, fighter pilot like myself, so we may talk a little flying and a few other things like that, but for the most part, it's going to be NASA, so don't miss that. And, of course, go to the website, usatalkradionetwork.com. You can see other upcoming shows that I've got some great guests next week. And tomorrow, we'll be broadcasting again live from Sao Paulo, Brazil. I'm in Sao Paulo. Of course, nobody else is, but all the Brazilians are here, but my guests are not here. But I'm broadcasting live from Sao Paulo, Brazil today and tomorrow. So please apologize if for any reason the sound quality isn't quite up to par or it breaks up a little bit. But typically, my broadcasting out is fine. Sometimes I have a little trouble hearing people, but we'll just go with the flow. And, of course, Paula will take over if we end up having any significant problems. Of course, Paula is broadcasting from Boston, Massachusetts. Say hi, Paula.
What's up, Tom? How are you?
Good. How's the weather? Was it a little warmer today in Boston than it was yesterday?
It is not. It's only 43 today and fair. Still overcast, and it's going to go downhill from here, from what I understand.
Oh, boy. Well, that's one of the reasons I moved away from there.
Yeah.
Couldn't take it any longer. Yeah, well, it's been pretty nice. I tell you, it wasn't real hot here in Sao Paulo today, but it was humid. And when I walked out of the grocery store, I could really feel it. But it made me feel at home because that's how it is in Florida right now. In fact, it's warmer in Florida and just as humid. So it was actually, for me, a very nice day. So those are our upcoming guests. And remember, you can always go to the website and download or stream any past shows. We've had some great shows over the last few weeks. Mark Ross on the 14th talking about what really is a conservative. And we're going to do a follow-up with that here in a few weeks, possibly, maybe in a month, on what is a liberal. It's not what you really think. Today's liberal is what we refer to as a liberal, but the true term about liberal is something a whole lot different, and so we're going to talk about that. We had Paul Skousen, son of the famed Cleon Skousen, author of The 5,000-Year Leap, and if you don't know much about that book, please go Google that and take a look at that and get a hold of that book. Great book on the discussion of the Constitution. Nick Taxia back on the 18th. If you go to the website, you can click on any of the past shows there in the middle of the screen, and it will take you to the page where everything's archived. And one of the things I'll do here in the next few days is go through and update the archives to give you a little better idea of what really went on the show, besides just sort of the headlines. I'll give you some highlights. And so anyway, let's get to our guest. Susan Bradford just came out with a book last month called Lynched. And she is a Washington-based D.C. investigative journalist who's dedicated over 4 years of her life. Boy, that's a long time to be researching one aspect or one issue, but 4 years of her life researching the Jack Abramoff scandal, to prepare for this book. She interviewed over 400 sources who had participated in or otherwise knew about some key events, and acquired substantial corroborating paperwork, and lived on the Indian reservations of the Abramoff's former tribal clients. So welcome, Susan, and how are you doing today?
Hi, I'm doing very well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me on your show today.
Well, listen, Susan, is there anything else we should tell the folks about your background, and how can they find out more about the book? Where can they go? And, you know, whether it's Twitter, Facebook, webpage, put it all out there. Let everybody know.
Okay, well, I do have a webpage, which is www.susanbradford.org, and there I've archived a number of original videos from the Indian tribes, some of reports which update the investigation, and I have a statement there from former Saginaw Chippewa Indian chief Maynard Kagageb Jr., who basically challenges John McCain for the lies that he purported in the Senate Indian Affairs Committee. And Maynard, as he is known for on the reservation, is actually asking for an investigation into McCain's hearings. So that page is a great page. It's a great resource. It provides a synopsis of the book. And you can buy the book on Amazon, also directly through my webpage, and it will be available in bookstores in the near future. It's also available as in Kindle version, which you can download from my website.
Awesome. Oh, that's great. Gee, you know, that would break my heart if John McCain got in trouble with the law again. Remember him squirming in his seat during the SNL debacle back in the, I guess that was the 70s, wasn't it? Boy, it would just break my heart. Yeah, well, I hope they do have a little investigation. He's getting so old. Hey, you know what? But he ran. He ran and got reelected, so he's got 6 years to go here. Well, 5 years now. Hey, he's fair game, and I think hopefully something will come out of this. Well, that's great. I'm glad to hear that. You made my day today, Susan, by telling me that. Well,
you know, I just read one of his one of his books called "Worth the Fighting For," and John McCain pretty much, which is written by John McCain with the help of his speechwriter Mark Salter. And he does document that, you know, his character, which has been, you know, he's been kind of a rogue operator and has gotten away with so much over the years. He almost takes pride in what he calls character, but I think it's very bad and self-serving character. Like, he has positioned himself to be one of the leading politicians who's under the influence of special interests, insurance, big oil, the automotive industry, Indian tribes, everything, any special interest group with money and clout. John McCain is right there, and I think he's really, you know, wanted to talk about corruption. He should really, you know, walk the talk, I think.
Yeah, he had a reputation in the Navy for, you know, things along those lines, and I guess he's a little bit of a braggart about stuff that most of us wouldn't want to be bragging about. We're going to get to him a little later, because I've got a specific question about him. But tell me what, and feel free to freelance here and tangent off anytime you want, because we want to know what, you know, is most interesting out there. And of course, you wrote the book, so you know what are the most important things and what will interest people the most. But what was it initially got you interested in even investigating this incident?
Well, at the time Abramoff was pleading guilty, I was working within the interfaith community, and I knew that I'd heard Abramoff's name. He was known as a man of great integrity and honor, wisdom, compassion. He was well-loved and well-revered throughout the religious communities and also throughout Capitol Hill. So I really was quite shocked to hear the media besmirching his character as they did. And what they were proclaiming in feigned shock and horror amounted to two traditional lobbying activities, and he was, you know, after all, a lobbyist. And given how, you know, how passionately they were trying to defame him, I thought, you know, he must have somehow offended the establishment in some fashion, and they've turned on him. And so I wanted to find out how and why, and since he was being denied his truth and denied a voice, essentially, in the argument, I wanted to dig up the information surrounding, you know, his case and then provide him a voice through my book, as it were, so that we can get the truth out about what really happened.
Yeah, okay. Well, good. I mean, so now, just one question that I hadn't planned on asking you, or kind of did, but I didn't know where I was going to ask it. Have you ever gotten to actually meet and speak with Jack Abramoff?
Yes, I did. I met with him before prison. I met with him frequently during his incarceration, sometimes as often as once a week. But I have to say, and a lot of people do ask, Did he participate in the book? And the answer to that question is no. One of the stipulations that he made up front, and which he made to other reporters as well, is that he could not discuss the cases as per his relationship as per his agreement with the federal government. So I honored that. But during his incarceration, I did freely send him information that I was uncovering, as I did other interested parties, including attorneys and other lobbyists, because I think a lot of people were very confused about the confluence of lies that were being circulated. But yes, I did actually meet him, and he's a charming person.
Okay, well, I sent him a message on Facebook a couple days ago saying that you were going to be on the radio show. So he may be listening right now. He didn't respond, but that doesn't mean he's not listening, or may go and download it later on, and hopefully this will be something that maybe will be of value to him and useful to him in the future. But I know Paul is dying to ask a question.
Susan, what was the point where you knew you were on to something?
Thank you for asking that. I started my investigation in Florida, of all places, looking into his Florida fraud. He was, caught up in the Sun Cruise fiasco. And I started by pulling up the bankruptcy proceedings. I called the two banks which were involved, Wells Fargo and Citadel Equity Fund. Wells Fargo did not return my phone calls. Citadel Equity Fund pointed me to the direction of the bankruptcy proceedings which followed after the loan fell apart. And within that paperwork, you will see that Wells Fargo engaged in a secret agreement with Adam Kadan, whereby they were going to accept IOUs in lieu of an equity payment. And we also see that the payment was to come directly from Adam Kadan, that it had no it had nothing to do with Abramoff. He wasn't responsible for raising the money. So then the question would become, well, how did he get involved in this? I also found that there was one letter written by Ben Waldman, who was the president of Sun Cruise, who essentially wrote to the judge and said, look, Abramoff was not guilty. He was not party to this fraud. I know because I witnessed Adam Kadan send him blank signature sheets. Abramoff did not have an attorney at closing. He was not involved in the negotiations of the deal. I mean, he had no part of this. That was the only letter written to the judge which was withheld from the public. So I thought that was very interesting. And as I pursued my investigation through Indian country, I found consistently that the paperwork that I unearthed directly contradicted all of the allegations purported in the Senate Indian Affairs Committee, in the media, and ultimately, from the federal government. So there was a huge disconnect. And that's, I guess when I knew that, there was obviously a conspiracy. But the conspiracy came out, I think, when I began to talk to some of the lobbyists and the tribal dissidents involved in setting up Abramoff. They all consistently spoke from the same playbook, using verbatim word choice and describing events which completely contradicted the paperwork. And so I guess from there I got the sense that there was a conspiracy. And later one of the lobbyists who coordinated it all admitted, well, yes, actually there was one, and I'm the one who did it. And that was Tom Rogers.
Wow. Right. Okay. Say his name again.
Tom Rogers, I believe he's the owner of Carlisle Consulting.
Okay. Now, I find it interesting that Jack was signing these blank sheets. He must have had a lot of faith in his so-called partner, Adam Kadan, who basically screwed him on this whole thing. Did he ever talk to you about his relationship with Adam?
He didn't, but I did talk to Jack's wife, Pam, and she said that Adam was always trying to impress upon people how he was a wealthy man. He dressed the part. He pretended that he was throwing money around and had just sold I think his bed mattress business for a very large sum of money, and was on top of his game. He had a lot of people fooled. Most people, even the local journalists, said that after I read about all of his conniving, I couldn't believe it because he was so charming to all of us. And I think one of Jack Abramoff's His Achilles heel was that he thought the best of other people. He assumed the best. And so I don't think I think he wanted to believe that Adam, you know, that his representations were in fact accurate. I do know in the case of the blank signature sheets, Ben Waldman, you know, who was the president of Sun Cruise, sent them to Abramoff, and Waldman, by his own reports, said that he asked Kadan, you know, why can't we send them the actual closing documents? And Kadan always said, there isn't time, you know, we have to close now. So he incorporated, you know, a high level of pressure. And so Abramoff, you know, assuming the best, went ahead and signed it. But long after the deal closed, Kadan still had not sent him the closing documents. So it took him a long time, about him, I mean Abramoff, to actually realize that he had been defrauded in the deal.
Okay. Well, now let's talk about Sun Cruise. Explain to people what Sun Cruise is and why that upset some people, the people that end up being the players in this scandal, and then if there are some other players in this thing you want to name, please do. But explain to them what Sun Cruise was and why that got people hot under the collar over Mr. Abramoff and what he was doing.
Sun Cruise was a fleet of gaming ships, which allowed pensioners who were the main clientele to game off offshore. And I believe that at the time Florida did not allow gaming, so this was one of the avenues for them to gamble. Sun Cruise was also in direct competition with the Seminole Tribe of Florida. The Seminole Tribe was the first tribe to pursue gaming, and it set the standard that tribes across the country followed. That tribe happened to be represented by Scott Reed and Larry Rosenthal, who were vying for gaming business against Abramoff throughout the country. So not only, you know, was he competition elsewhere, but he was placing, they knew that given his clout and his influence, that he probably would have somehow obstructed the efforts of the Seminole Tribe, you know, to pursue gaming. And as we know, you know, after the fact, they have negotiated a very lucrative deal with the state of Florida.
Okay.
As for who was Rosenthal? Rosenthal is, I'm sorry, is he was the former. He's assistant to Congressman Dale Kildee, who's the chair of the Native American Caucus, and then Scott Reed was John McCain's, presidential campaign director in Arizona from 2000.
I see. Okay. So now, help me with this. Let's say Adam Kadan had not been misrepresenting himself, and the deal that was cut to I guess expand Sun Cruise, is that what it was? Expand Sun Cruise and expand the gaming, et cetera. If there had been no improprieties there, then there would have really been. Would there have been a scandal?
Probably not.
Opponents of him. Okay, so the competition for gaming in Florida and even elsewhere wouldn't have had anything to try and bring them down. So the bottom line was this. They didn't like the competition, and they found a weakness in this financing deal that Abramoff didn't know about, and that's what they used to set him up. Okay.
That's
so they
correct,
would have had
but
much,
they
much
exploited
to,
it.
Okay, they exploited it. Otherwise, they as far to your knowledge, would they have had anything else they could have used against Mr. Abramoff?
Well, I know that they were trying very hard. Back in, I think it was 2003, the Seminole Tribe contributed $200,000 to the DCCC to essentially take out Tom DeLay, who is, you know, the Senate Majority Leader, for gerrymandering in Texas. So the liberals were already upset with Abramoff. They were upset with him on many fronts. You know, he was very successfully advancing the conservative agenda, and you know, kind of keeping government expansion in check. But also in Michigan and elsewhere, there were a number of initiatives to expand gaming casinos, and Abramoff was able to block them very successfully. So I think Florida gave them, you know, was his Achilles heel. But I think that they were trying to obstruct him elsewhere. However, if the Florida fraud hadn't happened, I think they would have had a much more difficult time, creating a scandal against him.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Now, I know Paul and I talked about McCain a little bit earlier, and you just mentioned that Scott Reed, this would have been after the fact, correct, that Scott Reed was then a campaign manager, you said, for John McCain?
Scott Reed was the campaign manager back in 2000, so it was before
the fact. That's right. Okay, so I know you had. So I know you had a question about Scott Reed, Paula. Go ahead, and I'll let you go.
No, I wanted to know a little bit more about him. If she could tell us a little bit more about Scott Reed.
Scott Reed was a political operative. He served in the Republican National Committee under Haley Barbour, who's now the governor of Mississippi. Once Bush became president, he then tried to enter the gaming business. There was an article written up in the Village Voice, which I think should be archived, which shows that Scott Reed colluded, if you will, with another lobbyist, Roger Stone, who was or is a lobbyist for Donald Trump. And they were working together to sabotage their professional rivals within the Bureau of Indian Affairs. During the setup of Abramoff, I did notice that there was a $10,000 fee or consultancy fee between Scott Reed and Abramoff's tribal client. So I know that he was advising them. His name also comes up on the paperwork where he was helping to coordinate the assault against Abramoff and essentially helping to deliver him to the Senate Indian Affairs Committee.
Okay, and so what was Abramoff accused of?
He was accused of in Indian country, you mean?
Say it again?
Do you mean in Indian country?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, there were a few things. One is that he had a kickback scheme, which they called, Gimme Five, between
yes.
himself and Michael Scanlon, his public relations executive. However, the truth was that the five, when they were, high-fiving each other with Gimme Five, that wasn't their gloating over, doing in a client. Phrase actually referred to their out-of-the-box creative strategies to win on behalf of their clients. So that was kind of like an inside joke between the two of them. As a lobbyist, Abramoff was not required within his to officially announce his relationship with Scanlon. He was a lobbyist and not an attorney. And in just about every client, every tribal client that I spoke to, they all said consistently, yes, we knew about the relationship. Yes, we were agreeable to it, so it wasn't something that they hid. In fact, Michael Scanlon was on the payroll at Greenberg Traurig. They even knew about him. They maintained his paperwork and his files and his billing arrangements. Everybody knew. Everybody was agreeable to it. They were the top and most competitive team in Washington, D.C. But Abramoff was accused of overbilling his clients or trying to take advantage of them. However, the contracts were negotiated by high-priced attorneys on both sides of the equation. There was no way, even if he wanted to take advantage of them, that he could have. But his deliverables were phenomenal. For example, for $14 million, he was able to deliver appropriations to the Saginaw Chippewa Indian Tribe in the amount of $20 million. And he was also able to protect their casino market share, which was valued at hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars. So they definitely got their money's worth. But they were essentially accusing him, of bilking them just to enrich himself. But the return that they received was phenomenal.
Wow. Yeah, I think I'd read that before, that he was accused of kind of scamming his clients when in fact the reality was he gave them a very good return on investment. Regardless of how much he made, they got a very good return on investment. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. And there was one of the leading witnesses against Abramoff, Bernie Sprague, who was the Saginaw Chippewa sub-chief. He accused Abramoff or Michael Scanlon of selling the tribe a database for $4.5 million. But the paperwork for a database that they never received. However, a few days before he appeared in the hearings, Bernie Sprague loaned the database out to the state of Michigan to help his uncle get a casino for the Gun Lake tribe. And if you recall, you know, John McCain interrogated Stephen Griles over Gun Lake on behalf of, you know, Bernie Sprague. So essentially, you know, they were spreading falsehoods against him because, you know, he was effectively, I guess, blocking casinos and many casinos in which some of the accusers had a personal and/or financial stake.
Okay. Hey, I'm going to get to McCain here in a second, but
okay.
You mentioned Charlie Crist in the mm-hmm. In your discussion of different things and in the book, and I just saw a friend of mine. He has the Shark Tank here in Florida. If you want to find out, Javier Manjares, he does the Shark Tank, and it's great for Florida stuff. Anybody in Florida wants to find out what some of the hot topics are and some of the scuttlebutt going around, go check out the Shark Tank. He's on Facebook, and he's also on the web, but he just kind of jabbed Charlie Crist a little bit, and so when I was looking over my notes, I saw that you mentioned Charlie Crist as well. How's Charlie Crist or anybody associated with Charlie Crist involved in this deal here? What was going on?
Well, Charlie Crist was Attorney General of Florida during this period. And I thought it was very interesting that after Abramoff was sent to the gallows, the son of the judge who presided over the Florida case, which is Paul Huck Jr., he then joined Charlie Crist's a gubernatorial campaign, and then once Charlie Crist was elected, Paul Huck Jr. turned around and negotiated a very lucrative deal for the Seminole Tribe of Florida. And so there appeared to be some kind of kickback scheme there as well, and I think he may have been rewarded as well by being flouted as a possible running mate for John McCain, you know, for his 2008 presidential run.
Yeah, yeah. Wow, that's so surprising. Now, when we were talking before, yeah, well, I'm glad Charlie's gone. I mean, there, a lot of people still like him. And one of the things Javier pointed out today was the crazy thing is, you know, even with all of the shame of Charlie switching to become an independent and suddenly not endorsing people he had endorsed when he was, quote, a Republican, now all of a sudden he's not endorsing those people and he's giving money to Democrats. And then, of course, all of the money he raised back when he was a Republican, he kept and did not give back. I mean, all these things. He still got 1.6 million votes. 1.6 million votes in Florida. Like a friend of mine said, in a particular country, I saw a dictator who came back and I'm like, why would they bring this? Why would they welcome this dictator back who stole hundreds of millions of dollars from the government? And my friend said, well, we have two kinds of people here, stupid and stupider. So anyway, 1.6 million people voting for Charlie Crist. We have a lot of sheeple out there, I guess. But so to get to John McCain, you were talking about sort of a loophole in the McCain-Feingold bill that's supposed to limit, you know, campaign contributions. And I guess it was actually Abramoff was using this loophole, but I think you said McCain established a loophole in his campaign finance legislation, which then allowed the Indian tribes and the principal clients of Abramoff's to make unlimited donations to political campaigns. Tell us how that worked, and was it John McCain that snuck that in there into his own bill?
Yes, you know, John, thank you for asking that. And John McCain is such an opportunist. He knew that by rewriting the campaign finance law, that he could then prosecute his political enemies for flying afoul of that law. Essentially, the law we're talking about is McCain-Feingold, and the legislation drove money underground, so it kind of forced Abramoff and other lobbyists to create these conduits in order to conduct their lobbying campaigns. So those were the conduits that John McCain criticized in his investigation. But since John McCain was positioning himself as, you know, for the chairmanship of the Senate Indian Affairs Committee, he wanted to make sure that he could get the greatest haul of money possible from that arrangement. So he created a loophole in McCain-Feingold, which allowed Indian tribes to essentially give an unlimited amount of money to political candidates. And of course, John McCain received the largest haul of that. And in turn, John McCain, he's banking on the fact that the members of the general public would not be aware of that. He then released Jack Abramoff's campaign contributions, kind of making it appear as though he was bribing all of Capitol Hill. But you could find the same campaign list among most, if not all, tribal lobbyists. And there was also another loophole which exempted Indian tribes from the gift ban. So essentially, since all of most of his clients were tribes, they could shower gifts like tickets to events and meals onto the players of Capitol Hill. John McCain didn't mention that either, as he tried to make the case that Abramoff was providing a stream of things of value, to officials on Capitol Hill in order to bribe them, when the reality was that, those things, he probably, shouldn't have done it, but they didn't guarantee they did not guarantee results. They essentially allowed him to build relationships. Because if you think about it, what legislator of any stature would allow for an appropriation of $20 million for a new tribal prison in order to receive a few tickets to American Idol? It doesn't really make a lot of sense. Right. But that was the case that John McCain tried to make.
Yeah, well, geez, that doesn't surprise me about John McCain. Anyway, I won't say too much more about him, but anyway, all right, Paula, go ahead.
How was Abramoff's partner, a bankrupt lawyer, able to get a nine-figure loan using IOUs instead of a down payment?
That's a very good question, and I don't think that Wells Fargo, which was the bank that coordinated that, ever expected the truth to see the light of day. If you look at the bankruptcy proceedings, the documents surrounding that, you'll see that Wells Fargo tried to hide this arrangement from the secondary lender, Citadel. So essentially they told the secondary lender, we are going to accept equity capital for the loan, while they're telling and agreeing with Adam Kadam that they are going to accept IOUs. And as for why they did this, it's anybody's guess. But I can tell you that after the deal imploded, Wells Fargo was claimed by Scott Reed as a client, and then they went on to make record profits in Indian country, really commanding one of the largest market shares for banking, among the very lucrative tribal gaming market.
Okay, and how did this hurt Abramoff?
It hurt him in a number of ways. One was that at the time he was joining Greenberg Traurig as a lobbyist. Greenberg Traurig offered to negotiate the settlement with Sun Cruz on his behalf, because they wanted him to then devote his time to lobbying. But instead, they then gave his information to the federal government, violating attorney-client privilege, so that the federal government could then turn around and prosecute him. And I think once the deal imploded, Abramoff's rivals were then able to use the press, the bad press surrounding that deal, to then disparage him and among his tribal clients, which they did. Like they were taking his articles about it and distributing them to all of his tribal clients, to show look, you want to fire him because he's a disreputable guy.
Now, you say again, because it broke up a little bit on my end here. Who was it that was representing Abramoff and then violated that attorney-client privilege?
That was Greenberg Traurig, which also was represented by Randy Schuneman, a former congressional aide of John McCain. So Greenberg Traurig was under the advisement of John McCain.
Okay, and that's the name of the firm, Greenberg. Say that one more time.
Greenberg Traurig. That was the firm in which Abramoff
Greenberg
worked
Barry?
For.
Traurig. Okay, you say it, Paula, if you can say it, so we can tell everybody out there, if you think you need some representation, don't look to this company for representation, because they don't treat you too good. Can you say that name? Because, again, it's breaking up at my end, but can you repeat that, Paula?
Sure, it's Greenberg Traurig.
Truarez.
Greenberg Tuareg. Okay. Tuareg.
Tuareg.
Well, it's in your book, I'm sure, and it may even be on your website. But yeah, if you come, don't avoid all Greenbergs. I had a classmate named Greenberg, and I don't think he's a lawyer. But you never know; these things people go. I almost went to law school a few years ago. I was thinking about doing it, and then I decided, nah, there are funner things that I can do. So anyway, all right. Well, hey, just in case anybody out there is interested in calling in, I know this stuff's fascinating, and I wouldn't even begin to know where to even think about asking. Questions. I just want to be sitting there listening to it, but I've read a lot of your stuff, Susan, and we've talked about things. But remind people where they can go to get information about your book and about anything to do with this subject and any other projects you may be working on.
Sure. Again, you can go to my website, which is www.susanbradford.org. And my articles and videos, and most of my information, or the information, new information about the Abramoff investigation, is documented there. You can also buy the book
and the
from
videos.
The
okay, and the videos, is that you explaining something, or is it videos from other news sources, or what are the videos that people might be able to see?
Okay, one is a video of Maynard Kagagiev, the Saginaw Chippewa Indian chief who retained Abramoff, and he's essentially challenging John McCain's lies against him. He's calling for an investigation. The other videos, some of them are just to give you an idea of who the characters are, like Scott Reed, Tom Rogers, Roger Stone, some of these lobbyists who are working behind the scenes to sabotage Abramoff. And then I also have a lot of videos which you can access on my YouTube channel and also on my website, which these are original videos taken from the Indian tribe, within the Indian tribe, by tribal members. And one of them we have Fred Cantu, who's a Saginaw Chippewa Indian chief, who boasts that John McCain is one of his closest and dearest friends. Fred Cantu is the son of illegal immigrants, of illegal Mexican immigrants. He's now he was a chief of an Indian tribe. There are also some videos of Congressman Dale Kildee, who talks about how the liberals took over Indian country, and there are a few of some of the culprits. One is of Larry Rosenthal bragging about how he took out Abramoff. Another is about with one of the whistleblowers, Dolores Jackson, challenging Bernie Sprague, one of the witnesses who committed perjury in McCain's hearings. And she's able to get Bernie to admit that his uncle controls Gun Lake. And of course, as I mentioned before, John McCain mentioned Gun Lake in the Senate Indian Affairs Committee, or he grilled Stephen Griles over that tribe on behalf of Bernie Sprague.
Uh-huh. Okay. Interesting. Well, so how many videos total do you have there, would you say, that you have on your site?
Oh, gosh. I think maybe about 20 or so. And I don't know if we've mentioned this or if your audience might be interested, but I'd be happy to share with them how the scheme was set up in Indian country.
Yeah, please do.
If they're interested. I guess as you know, the Florida leg became one trap that they had set for him. And then we looked, if we can look at the different Indian tribes around the nation, including the Louisiana Cushada and the Saginaw Chippewa Indian tribe, you will see that tribal dissidents who were represented by lobbyists close to John McCain leaked false information about Abramoff into the local media, which was then picked up by the Washington Post. In particular, one which I think is just so brazen is that the Louisiana Cushada, one of the dissidents, David Sickey, told the American Press newspaper that he said, Abramoff's fees are so outrageous that we're being forced to dig into our sacred funds in order to pay him. However, a few days after that article ran, the newspaper printed a retraction in which the same witness said, I was mistaken, I take back what I said. the tribal council had, you know, shamed him for, you know, for trying to create a quote-unquote illusion of crisis. But at the same time, the Washington Post took that story and ran with it as if it were the gospel truth. The lie was then repeated by that same dissident in the Senate Indian Affairs Committee hearings, and then it was immortalized in the final report, which provided a summary of, you know, of those allegations, or of the allegations purported in the committee. So you can see how they set it up. They got it to the Washington Post. These tribal dissidents and lobbyists worked with the PR firm to then blanket the country with all of these falsehoods against Abramoff in order to provide McCain a pretext, you know, to call for the hearings, and then, you know, essentially setting him up to be, presidential candidate for, you know, in 2008, you know, kind of like, you know, where he's emerging as a reformer and somebody who's, you know, really, you know, strong about, you know, about challenging corruption.
Wow. So it sounds to me like the committee, as well as John McCain, could very easily have known about this testimony being taken back by the individual who initially said it, if they wanted to know, or they probably knew, but they ignored it.
I think the lobbyists placed the information there intentionally to entrap him. Did they ignore it? That's a good question. I know that William Morphal, who was a former Louisiana Coushatta council member, He easily refuted the allegations, and you know he was in turn represented by Roy Fletcher, who also worked for John McCain, and so I think through Warfel, McCain must have known, and I can't imagine that the federal officials, you know, who were investigating this didn't know, and that once finding that the allegations did not match the actual reports, you know, why didn't they then question the accusers instead of running with the lie?
Right. You know, it almost sounds like we see this in the movies all the time. You wonder if it really happens, and I doubt it happens that much in law enforcement. But the protagonist cop who is wants to get the caller, and they've caught somebody, and then you got the other cops that feel like, I don't know if there's, I don't know if we have enough evidence. Oh, no, this they just drop it, forget about it, and they just want to move forward because they're satisfied that they've got somebody that looks guilty and they've got some evidence, and they just want to keep ignoring it. It almost seems kind of stupid. My time in the military, there were times that things I had to investigate and look at. I wanted to know the truth. I didn't want to just find an easy answer and then go with it and then one day find out that, oops, I was wrong. I wanted to actually know. But it sounds like there's a certain level of arrogance here, particularly among the politicians, when it comes to condemning somebody or, just moving along a case, an investigation, and saying, hey, look at me. Look at me. I'm a reformer, and I'm the kind of guy that ought to be president of the United States because I don't put up with, you know, this kind of stuff.
I think that's very true. A lot of these prosecutors, and I'm sure that there are many individuals of integrity among their ranks, but a lot of them are headline chasers. And I'm sure that careers can be made by securing a prosecution, whether it's warranted or not. And you're right. You know, a lot of politicians did not want to be caught up in the lie that they could emerge as noble people if they were to go along with it. In fact, a number of them did use the Abramoff scandal to keep their seats and to attack their opponents. But of course, even among this bunch, that there were a few individuals, like I think Dana Rohrabacher, who was among them, who did stand up for the truth and very graciously and honorably was able to state that I was not defrauded by Jack Abramoff. I do stand by him. And I think I commend those individuals who had the courage and the strength of character, to stand by what was right and true.
Well, and it also seems like the media likes to sensationalize things, and I would think that finding out that this was all a big scam, the media would like to really run with that. But they, I think, again, their attitude is sort of like, number one, most of the media is liberal, so they like the idea of going after somebody that might have been either conservative or helped conservatives. And two, it's old news. We don't care. We made this guy look really bad in the media and printed all of the news that was bad, and now there may be something coming out that would refute that. Yeah, we want to move on because it kind of makes us look bad. Do you get that impression from the media?
I do. I'm actually astounded, you know, at the level of, you know, of the lies which were purported and the level of the names involved. You'd think that they would be dumping all over this story, but I've received almost a wall of, before me where they did not even want to touch it. And I'd have to say, like, when I began looking into this, I saw that a number of lobbyists who had worked previously with John McCain are representing these news organizations. And if you can imagine, you know, most of our media today, they are, multi-billion-dollar enterprises which have strong commercial interests. Like, they're trying to expand their market share. They're trying to get into broadband and so forth. And the way, and they have to rely upon congressmen and our elected officials in order to consolidate and expand their market share. And, of course, who sits on the Commerce Committee but John McCain, you know, who has presided over some of the great mega mergers among the media and has even authored legislation which has helped them along. So, of course, they don't want to alienate or investigate John McCain, who has essentially been a gravy train for them. I think there's that issue as well.
Yeah, they didn't help him out too much in the presidential campaign, but I think that was kind of a, well, sorry, John, we've got to do what we got to do, but don't worry, once it's all over, we'll be on your side again. Yeah, interesting. Now, Susan, is there anything else you're working on right now? You got any other projects going that we should tell people about?
I am working on, I guess, a few other books. I don't know if I want to go into all of that just now, but one of them does involve investigating the connection between the Indian tribes and the major investment banks.
Okay, interesting.
I thought that was interesting.
Good.
I do have
question, Susan. Oh, go ahead, Paula.
After Abramoff had pled guilty to the illegal lobbying, the officials at the White House said that they barely knew him and that he had gone to a couple of receptions and that all that they knew about him was what they read in the paper, right?
Correct.
Okay, so was it ever quantified as to how many contacts he actually had with White House officials?
I think Congressman Henry Waxman came out with a report which documented that I think his team made over 400 contacts. But I think at the end of the day, his lobbying was not really dependent upon the White House. I think they were more of a bit player. Though Abramoff did have a close relationship with Karl Rove, you know, who's the White House advisor, and Ken Mellman, who was the political director. And very interestingly, after Waxman came out with his report documenting that Mellman did not report some tickets he received from Abramoff's team, Abramoff was immediately ushered into prison, preventing the investigation from going forward. And then Ken Mellman joined the firm Akin Gump, which had represented a number of the tribal witnesses within the Senate Indian Affairs Committee, and which also employs John McCain's personal attorney, John Dowd, who represented him in the Keating's Five scandal. So essentially they were able to provide cover, you know, for their own people. But his relationship with George Bush was pretty strong. I know that a lot of the lobbyists were jealous of him because he was always invited to sit on the dais with George Bush, like a privilege that was not afforded to the other lobbyists. So he did have a very coveted position, you know, in the Bush administration.
He said, yes, you say that, but I had also heard as well that Bush had turned around and said he didn't even know the guy.
That's true, and I think Time magazine produced a photograph which, you know, of a smiling Jack Abramoff in the audience of
right?
A meeting with George Bush.
Here, go figure.
Yeah.
Go figure.
Well, one of the things that we're going to do to help you get out your message and future stuff, Susan, is we've offered you a slot to do some broadcasting on the USA Talk Radio Network. We've already got a page up for you, and it's just whenever you're comfortable and ready to start doing that, we'd love to have you do that because you're somebody who has a sense of what's going on in D.C. and in the political world that some of us just don't get to see. And you've already, just because of this book here, and I'm sure whatever you've done in the past, you've really probably made some pretty good contacts and dug up some pretty good information that can be used in other venues. So we look forward to having you do some broadcasting when you get the chance. And, of course, you're welcome to come back on the show anytime you want. Is there anything else we should tell the people about this book or anything else that's going on in D.C. right now that you see that you think is noteworthy?
That's a very good question. I hope that the country will demand that John McCain reopen the Senate Indian Affairs Committee hearings. I think especially since the scandal emerged from Florida, I hope that the Floridians will demand a full account of what happened in this bank fraud and how John McCain and his cronies were allowed to foist the scandal on the American people, because I think it's very frightening. As my book documents, you know, McCain and various special interests were able to influence every branch of the government, and you can imagine how that reflects upon our ability to acquire justice, the integrity of our separation of powers. And I think that if we can challenge some of this, what has happened, that we will go a long ways towards, correcting the system and cleaning up the system. I'd also like to raise a bit of awareness about what's happening in Indian country. I'm not sure that many people know. These were created as offshore jurisdictions on American soil by the liberal financial elite. And Indian tribes have since been flooded with non-Indians who are then becoming welfare recipients. So if you can imagine, if you have 100,000, 200,000 tribal members, through one edict, you can get a tribe to force its tribal members to buy insurance or to buy any number of products. You could even have you could even force Indian country to impose insurance on on the millions of tribal members out there today. So that's a guaranteed market share. These Indian tribes have been taken over by non-Indians who are now controlling the governments and the gaming industry, and we have uncovered a number of examples where they are embezzling money from the federal government. And they're directing that money into the major investment banks, into some of these companies like General Motors, which are not too, they've created a very flawed business model, and instead of reforming and streamlining themselves, they reach into Indian country and take their share. We've also seen that they're able to acquire single source contracts, for hundreds of thousands of dollars, which are not taxed, and which the American taxpayer must subsidize. A large portion of that money remains unaccounted for, so it is essentially going into the pockets of special interests. So I think at this point, I would like to see some type of reform happen within Indian country, because I know that we're facing record deficits. And yet, our federal government doesn't seem too concerned about, wasting billions of dollars on, kind of questionable activities in Indian country. So hopefully that could be, something we could look into.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a good tip off. I mean, I don't know much about Indian country, if we'll call it that, or the tribal locations, and I realize that they are considered not necessarily, what's the right word for it, U.S. territory. It's not under U.S. jurisdiction, and yet we do have an influence on them, and it sounds like there is being some coordinating. I mean, I can see it being a perfect loophole to federal laws to say, hey, we can set something up on a reservation and coordinate something with a reservation, and then what they do, hey, that's their business. Those are under their laws. Yeah, that's very interesting.
And imagine that that Don McCain and other legislators have actually authored legislation which has said, we will roll back the federal government's oversight of that money. So do with it whatever you will. And here they are directing millions of dollars into it. You can only imagine where that money's going.
Yeah, exactly. And then, as you said, the loophole that McCain put in the McCain-Feingold bill that they can, is it political contributions they can make directly to a candidate or to PACs, or what are those political contributions? How are they able to use those?
I think it's up to $500,000 per election cycle to political campaigns. And if you can imagine that they are most likely anticipating some type of return for that. So then the legislators who receive that would be more open to them giving them appropriations or other kind of kickbacks for that money, knowing that they have, you know, there are hundreds of tribes throughout the country, and each one of them has the capacity to donate over, you know, up to $500,000 per election cycle. That's a lot of money.
Now, is it still limited, though, by the FEC requirements of, a maximum of $4,800 per both elections, primary and general, per individual, or does that not apply either?
I think that they are a little bit more lenient towards Indian tribes, but I don't know the specifics on that.
Okay. Well, I'm going to look that up. That's interesting. I'm going to look and see what that is myself, because I know, because I ran for Congress, I know what the limitation was. You could accept 2,400 in the prior to the primary, then another 2,400 after, and that's as U.S. Congress and Senate. I don't remember, because now you're covering the whole state. I don't remember if it was larger for the Senate or not. And then, of course, you start getting down to the state levels, then the numbers start dropping because they base it on the number of constituents you have that you're going to be representing. But, there are limitations, FEC limitations. And so, that's interesting. I'm going to look that up. But, listen, Susan, thanks for coming on the show. And did you have anything else for her, Paula?
No, I'm good. Thank you very much, Susan. It was great to meet you.
Oh, you too. And thank you so much for having me today.
We're still on track to do a C-SPAN interview one of these days if C-SPAN ever has an opportunity. Is that correct?
It is. I know that Book TV has indicated that they would like to broadcast an interview. So far, I'm working to coordinate a time and a date for them.
Okay.
I'll
send you. I've got a schedule now for next month, and I think you said Mondays. Were Mondays good? And
I think
Fridays?
Mondays and Fridays, I think.
Okay. I think I've got every Monday off next month, so. In any case, and of course, I'll be broadcasting, unless I change some trips around, I'll be broadcasting from here again next month, Sao Paulo, Brazil, when I come down here, and then, of course, on my days off, it'll be from South Florida. But, just so everybody else out there knows that C-SPAN Book, what's it called, TV Books?
It's called on Book TV.
Okay, that C-SPAN wants to do an interview of you and your book. Now, of course, they're not going to do the interview. You've been gracious enough to ask me to do the interview, and so we'll do an interview similar to this, but it'll be a sit-down interview, and you'll get to talk all about the book. And that'll be something that'll be broadcast and then posted on C-SPAN as a video, so that, I think, will be a great opportunity to get the message out. And we'll certainly let everybody know what the date of that is going to be, when it's going to air, and where they can go to find that out, and once that does transpire. So hopefully that'll be soon, because we need to get the word out on this, and it certainly will help. But we also need to get you broadcasting, too, so that you can – and you probably know – I know you do, Susan. You know lots of connectable or in-the-know people, and I know you could do a great show because you'll have a lot of good guests coming on there. And so whenever you're able to put that together, when you find the time, let me know. We'll put you on whatever time frame you want. Now, I didn't mention this earlier in the show because I didn't want anybody – if somebody actually is tuning into this and I mentioned it, I didn't want them to rush off. President Obama has been doing a town hall on Facebook today at the same time slot that we're airing. So, honestly, I don't think we lost any listeners because I would have a very hard time going. And, you know, those things are always a setup, and these electronic town halls, I realize for somebody like a president to do, okay, great, you're reaching the masses, I guess. But what is the town hall really about? Well, he's trying to sell his economic plan, or he's really just campaigning. What is it about? But they're really kind of setups in a way. You know, we can do them on this radio show and have lots of callers call in, and we can screen the calls and decide which questions we want to let the guest ask, etc. But it's easy to set those things up, and I've witnessed firsthand. My former congressional representative, Suzanne Cosmas, would do only electronic town halls. She did do a business town hall where she had invited business leaders, and they weren't all necessarily friendlies, but it was closed to the media, closed to the public. And those are the kind of things that I think, cowardly politicians do. Now, the president certainly does get out and do face-to-face, but we know those things are really a big setup. He has the power to ensure that only friendlies are there, because I would have a lot of questions. I mean, my first question, I actually thought about plugging in, not being able to attend, but just shoot off a question, was, why do you lie all the time? I know that's not a legitimate question and it would never get asked, but I'd love to ask him, you know, did you lie this much when you were a kid? And did your mom, you know, approve of that or what? What's the deal? Yeah, I guess it would have been his grandmother. But it just amazes me. And here's how I put it in perspective. My wife is from Canada, and until we got married back in 2000, she lived in Canada her whole life. And knew kind of on the surface what was going on in the States. The Canadians are pretty aware of politics and things, but not hugely, you know, deeply. But now, of course, being married to me and then also seeing what's on the news firsthand constantly flown across, I think she's always been a conservative person, and most of her family members are. But she's just – I just see her shaking her head all the time. She's like, I can't believe this stuff that's going on here. I just can't believe it. And she's just shocked. And so we may think that they're sort of liberal and socialistic there in Canada. On the other hand, she says the kind of stuff we're doing here politically and the maneuvering and the dirtiness and then the outright deception that goes on, she never saw that in her entire adult life in Canada and is just shocked at what's going on here. Now, I do know for a fact it's a lot worse than a lot of other countries because I travel these countries. You know, I've been in Venezuela and Colombia and Peru and Ecuador, and I'm not going to say anything bad about Brazil. I'm here right now. But we know that these other countries have had a lot of problems over the years, and they continue to have issues and to argue over politics and have these kind of problems. But I still think that some of the stuff that I see coming out of our own politicians in the U.S. right now are just almost over the top ridiculous. You know, it's almost like walking into a room with white painted walls and saying, oh, what pretty red painted walls. And then everybody nodding their head and going, oh, yeah, 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 because that's the party line. And it's an absolute lie. So anyway,
there's so much money at stake now. Sure.
Yes. Oh my gosh, the amount. I mean, to have a president say he's going to raise $1 billion for his next campaign. Wow. Gee, my goodness. I mean, you know, the reality ought to be this: you shouldn't have to raise a red cent. You ought to be able to just run on your record. But he can't. So he's got to put together a $1 billion campaign of deception. That's what he's got to do. But now, let me ask you this, Susan. Over the years, how much have you seen this politicking and just basically just outright lying? Have you seen it shift and change? And I read a lot about history in the early part of our country, and I see the mudslinging that went on, but this kind of outright deception and corruption, I don't think it went on. I haven't found it going back, you know, the early 1800s.
Well, you know, I think I would attribute this to, and this is the Rockefeller established order, and, you know, the drive is essentially among these companies and politicians is to create the mega monopolies. Through the monopolies, they can shower campaign contributions on to Capitol Hill and turn getting, you know, billions of dollars in kickbacks. I think the politicians have grown accustomed to receiving that money and knowing that if they just play the game, you know, they can get the money that they need for their campaign contributions. And of course, if they go against the grain, they can risk being run out of office on, you know, frivolous charges or having, you know, PR firms enlisted against them. So I think it has become a lot worse. And I would attribute the increase of corruption to Indian tribes again. Because it appears that that billions of dollars have gone from the Indian tribes into the major investment banks, in turn providing capital for a number of our leading corporate interests to then merge and to become even greater behemoths. And once they do that, of course, they can then influence government, and as government expands, they know that they can work through the arms of the government to enhance their market share. So, you know, the relationship becomes so entrenched that I think that the lies are all about self-preservation. You know, and I know that, yeah. I'm sure there are a lot of people of integrity who want to do the right thing, but if they dare, you know, can they really stay in office?
Well, yeah, and that's why I felt comfortable that if I had gotten elected, I didn't even quite come close, but if I had gotten elected, I had nothing to lose. I wasn't going to quit my job as an airline pilot because I can fly it very extremely part-time, and I just wasn't going to go along with that stuff. I think we're seeing some people that are really sticking their guns, at least so far, in Congress and the Senate, like Marco Rubio and Alan West, and I'm very proud of my own Congresswoman, Sandy Adams, who on about a week or so ago voted against that remainder of the year bill, that sham of a $38 billion bill that turned out to only be a few hundred million dollars. And I got to see her a few days ago and talk about that, and she had just shaken her head. And so I said, I basically pat her on the back and said, good job, keep it up. That's what we want to see. And she does have that kind of integrity. I saw her in the campaign, not slinging any money, not talking dirty about anybody, sticking to the issues, and it got slung her way by a few candidates. And, she just – in fact, when it was going on, I ran into her a few times. Of course, we were opponents at the time, but we had a good relationship, and I wasn't going to do that to her, and she wasn't going to do that to me. And she said, it's really tough, Tom. It's really tough to just bite my tongue, keep biting my tongue, and just not respond to these allegations and the mudslinging and that sort of stuff. And she did, and I think in large part that's why she won. It was a close race, but she's the kind of person now that we need in Washington that really is going to stand up, and she's a tough lady. She's a very tough lady, and so that's the good thing about her, having her as a representative. She's not going to be intimidated. And she, unlike me, it's not that she's got another job or she's, whatever. She's got really nothing to lose. If she got somehow unelected or whatever, there's plenty of other things for her to do, and she's not worried about that. And so it's not, unlike some people, their job as a representative or a senator, that's a job. Oh, they don't want to lose that job. They at some point in their career, they probably can do well outside of that, but they love the power. And they want that. They need that money. It's pretty good money, and it opens a lot of avenues for investments and other things, and they utilize that for that. So it's a huge money maker. You look at somebody who never had a real job, like Barney Frank and others, who are millionaires or worth millions, and yet all they've ever been is a representative in their life, and they've never done any job that would have garnered them a lot of money, at least prior to becoming a representative, and yet they're multimillionaires. Gee, how did that work out? So
that's very interesting. Well, if I could ask you a question, what is your take on the Tea Party candidates that we currently have on Capitol Hill? Are you pleased with what they've done? Do you feel they are living up to their promises to the American people?
Yeah, I do.
Or have they become
that
part of the party?
Well, I mean, we know that we have some Tea Party candidates that are voting the party line right now, but the most prominent ones and ones that we recognize and know, they're doing a good job. And I know that it's amazing. I see people on the left calling folks like Michelle Bachmann and Sarah Palin, hateful, racist, and everything in the book. And yet, whenever I ask them, okay, well, name something they've done. Well, they never can give me any specifics or details. Tell me something specific this person has done or said that makes them a bad person. And they can't do it. And we just on this show, a couple times, and I'm going to repeat it because I think it's worth repeating. It's been in the news, but we played a clip of Obama. I think it was in I think it was maybe 2006 or 7 when he was asked specifically about doing presidential signing letters, and he said no, they're unconstitutional. He said the president has the authority to vote either for a bill or veto it. That's it, nothing else. And he said, I should know because I taught constitutional law. Well, he gave lectures on one specific aspect, the 14th Amendment, and one specific aspect of the 14th Amendment. So I don't know if that made him a professor, and I don't know if he taught constitutional law, but he should certainly know the Constitution. And so he made that very, very clear. And you agreed with me, Paul, that he made it very clear. This is unconstitutional, and I won't be doing it. And then we've got a couple instances, last week and this week, of his press secretary saying, oh, no, he was never against it. Oh, no, he just doesn't want it to be abused. Well, that's an outright lie. That's an outright lie. I mean, I can't be brought up on libel charges for saying this because I've got all the evidence in the world. He said he wouldn't do it. He told a lady in a town hall he wouldn't do it, and it's unconstitutional, and now he's saying he wasn't opposed to it. So now what I gathered from that is He's not opposed to violating the Constitution. He made it clear, as Mr. Constitutional Professor, law professor, that it's unconstitutional. And now, oh, he just doesn't want it to be abused. It's okay to do it, just don't abuse it. Well, what's the definition of abuse? I say the definition of abuse is doing it, period, like he originally said. So, I mean, this is the kind of stuff that is so blatant and just so out there, and the media kind of skims over. You know, they play it a little bit, but not that much. It's clear that the media doesn't want to harm his reputation by, but if a Republican had done that, I think it'd be on the news day and night, you know. But that's okay. When the ads start coming out, the sound bites are just going to be unbelievable. The sound bites of him saying one thing and then playing the sound bite of him saying something exactly the opposite are just going to be, they're going to be nonstop. There's going to be a lot of money sunk into just playing his own words out of his own mouth and show the absolute contradiction that this man is.
That's interesting. I guess he sees the Constitution as just as a tool to be molded according to his own political agenda. He doesn't respect it at all. It's like a means to an end to him. That's very distressing. You know that he has that he's established that pattern.
Mm-hmm. I think we lost.
But I think it will be very interesting as we move up to the next camp. You know, the next campaign cycle to see. You know, will the media call Obama on his hypocrisy? Don't you have the impression too, Tom, that the media appears to be, you know, they're cooling to him now. You know, they're not giving him the free pass anymore.
I think we lost him, Susan.
Oh, did we really?
I apologize for that.
That's okay. What is your take on that, Paula? Do you think that we...
There he is. Tom, are you there?
Yeah, I'm back. Well, there you go. I predicted at the beginning of the show. I said, hey, I might drop off, and that's what happened. It dropped off there momentarily. I had to dial back in.
It's okay.
I know you ladies could just keep it going without me. In fact, I probably should have hung up about half an hour ago and let you ladies just go on with it.
Well, you're an excellent host, Tom. I know we should probably end soon, but what I wanted to ask you is, do you feel you were mentioning that the media has essentially given Obama a free pass? Do you feel now that they are cooling towards him, or do you feel they will hold him more accountable now? I think that he has offended a lot of his liberal constituents.
Yeah, I think what's happened is his liberal constituents, by going into Libya and doing some other things, they're really ticked off. But on the other hand, do they want to see somebody like Mitt Romney get elected? I think they'd rather stick with him, even because it boils down to the lesser of two evils. And I think they are starting to see him as an evil. He's not living up to the liberal things that he said he would do, so he can move a little more to the center. And yet we know he really wants to go that direction. He just can't, because he cares about getting reelected, and that's really the goal and focus for him. So I think you're going to see a lot of independents voting against him, knowing that this is the way he operates, and hopefully we can put up a Republican candidate that is clearly somebody who appears to have more integrity than this guy and will stick to what they're looking for, or, you know, stick to the agenda that they're saying in the campaign versus simply, I'm going to tell you one thing, but once I get in there, hey, it's all game. And we did a show on this where we talked about the Depression and FDR. And that's exactly what he said. He said everything that everybody wanted to hear prior to getting elected, and then he did the exact opposite in almost every major policy issue that he had campaigned on. So I think people are getting tired of that, but the liberal left is going to stick with him because they don't have another choice. Now, if Hillary were to jump in this, or somebody else with her persona and her level of, you know, name recognition, I think then it would be very, very hard for him. It would be sort of like the who was the guy that jumped in the race with the original first Bush president? I'm trying to think. From Texas. I can't think of his name. Ross Perot, yeah. An independent jumps in there, or a Reform Party, which is what he created, the Reform Party. All of a sudden, it's a big spoiler because you've got a whole bunch of candidates or a whole bunch of voters that, you know, are conservative, and it kind of splits it up. And so that's what we need, is somebody to split up the Democrat vote. But in any case, yeah, I think that's unless somebody else steps up to the plate, he's going to be their man. They're very unhappy with him, but they're going to stick with him, and the media will ultimately stick with him as well. So in any case,
what are your thoughts of a Donald Trump candidacy?
Well, Donald isn't what he says.
He appears to have some kind of liberal support, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's got a colorful personality. He is a cult of personality, and he's somebody that could take Obama. It just depends on how much of his past comes out and people pay attention to it. You know, a lot of things came out about Obama that the masses just didn't care about or pay attention to. And I think the same would be true with Trump. But for true conservatives, he's not a conservative. Just recently Rahm Emanuel just ran for mayor, and he donated money to Rahm Emanuel. I mean, that's one of the last guys in the world I'd donate money to. I'd probably give it to Osama bin Laden before I'd give it to Rahm Emanuel. So I think, the masses, though, would certainly overlook a lot of that stuff. And I think, Trump has a shot at winning this. With that said, would I vote for him? No, I wouldn't vote for him because he's not a conservative. He's made statements about health care and things that I find very scary. And so I don't really have a real favorite candidate in this right now, but I certainly would if Trump got the nomination. Yes, I would campaign for him and work to get him elected because he's much further to the right than the true Obama president and candidate. But we've taken up a lot of your time, and we've gone over the show, but it's been fun and a blast. We'll have you back, Susan, and we'll get you on the air here pretty soon. So I'm going to let you go because I know that you need to get going, and we'll wrap up the show. And then we actually got a caller call in, so hope they want to talk to you, but I know you've got to go. So we'll take one caller and just see what they have to say, and then we can always I can always email you and get a follow-up from you. But in any case, okay. Appreciate it one more time. SusanBradford.org, where people can find out all the information they need about your book, Lynched, and how to get a hold of you.
Well, thank you so much for having me. Is the caller on air now, or have they fallen off?
Well, let's see who this is. Let's just see who it is. Paula just went to screen them, and it's somebody that looks like they're calling from the Palm Beach area, and we'll see. It might be somebody I know down in the Palm Beach area. So we'll see. We've got to make sure we don't have some nut job on there or somebody that hates me. And then if that's the case, we'll let you go, and then I'll take care of them, or we won't even have them on. But hopefully Paula's going to screen. I can see Paula's screening right now. We had a few of those already call in, and it's helpful to have somebody that can actually go and screen and see because, this is the thing. You know, some of these people on the left, they don't make sense. And
no, they don't. They're kind of a little unhinged, some of them.
Yeah, yeah. So let's see. Paula's coming back here. Who is it, Paula, that called in? Is it somebody I know?
Yeah, it's Steven Rosenblum.
Oh, Steve Rosenblum. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's bring Steve on.
Go ahead.
Steve, how you doing?
Excellent, Tom. Really hadn't had a chance to listen to your show before, and certainly hadn't called in before. So, and I was really enjoying it. So I just thought I'd take a moment and call in and say,
thanks for calling in.
Yeah, my pleasure. I mean, you guys are saying a lot of things that we were saying on our show earlier today and all week actually, especially about Donald Trump. Daria has really been delving deeply. My co-host Daria, for people who don't know, has been delving deeply into the whole Donald Trump thing and researching and going back and over his statements. And, we're very concerned about the fact that so many Republicans seem just so taken with him at face value, and nobody is really vetting him, and certainly the media is not vetting him. And it kind of reminds us of what happened with Donald Trump and to some degree with John McCain. The media wanted John McCain to be the Republican standard bearer, and there was a reason for that, because they knew he was not going to beat Barack Obama. And now they're doing the same thing with Donald Trump, who has contributed massively to a lot of liberals, Harry Reid, Rahm Emanuel, Wiener, Schumer. I mean, it's unbelievable the people he's contributed to. And
he's
not conservative.
Exactly. Well, now, what time are you guys broadcasting? Because are you still broadcasting the 5 o'clock time slot?
No, we only broadcast at one time at 5 o'clock. We're doing 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock Eastern time for CRF weekdays, and we're continuing our Saturday show from 6 to 7:30 p.m.
Okay, 2 to 3 o'clock, that's Steve Rosenblum, and your co-host is Daria DiGiovanni, and people can go to USA Talk Radio Network and find your page right there, and then, of course, you broadcast as well on Saturday and have a great show, and you get some great guests. Now, you said you weren't going to have guests during the week so you could make it more of a commentary. Have you, you did that one time that I came on the show. Have you had any more guests since then, or have you stuck with the commentary model?
We've been sticking to the commentary. We may very well have a gentleman by the name of Ilario Pantano, who ran for Congress last year and is going to run again in North Carolina. He's a Marine veteran. He's been really slammed brutally in the media, but he's a great guy, and we'd love to see him win in 2012. So we're going to give him another opportunity to come on the air with us. And then on Saturday we have V.S. McCotter.
Okay. Well, if that young Marine wants to come on my show, let me know, and we'll get him on the show as well so we can get, you know, as much information out about him as possible. But did you have a question for Susan, or can we let her go?
I actually didn't have a question specifically for Susan. I just been listening to your back and forth.
I had to step away there for a second. I had to step away there for a second because you could probably hear the phone ring in the background. I'm sitting here in the beautiful Hotel Grand Pullman in Sao Paulo, Brazil, and I bet that's one of the other pilots calling me to find out, hey, come on, where are you? Let's go to dinner. anyway, Susan, so we're going to let you go. Then we'll finish up with Steve here real quick. But thanks so much for coming on the show. We'll be in touch.
Thank you.
And we'll have you back on the show soon and keep us appraised of what's going on.
Very good. Nice to meet both of you again, and we'll talk soon.
You're very welcome.
Sounds good. Thanks, Susan. Bye now.
Thanks.
So Steve, just to recap, 2 to 3, you and Daria, you have some great guests. People, especially if they go back and look at your archives, you've had some great guests like Michelle Bachman and Steve King and done some great shows and really dug into some good
looks like we lost Tom.
I thought I lost the internet connection again. Pardon my language, but this happens down here all the time. So anyway, but anything else you want to let the folks know?
Like I said, we've got this Ilario Pantano, excuse me, on Friday during the 2 to 3 hour. This Saturday we have returning guest Congressman Thaddeus McCotter from Michigan. Who's always outspoken, and he has a really dry wit that reminds me a lot of Bob Newhart. And we have a certain guest that we're hoping to have in the near future. I did book Jedediah Vila, the Fox News contributor and pundit. She'll be on with us on May 8th. So we're just going to keep on plugging along and work with you to get this USA Talk Radio Network up and running at full speed, and that's about it.
Awesome, awesome. Well, we're glad to have you on board. Glad you joined us, and we'll be talking with you again in the future. Feel free to call in any time. And now that I know that you're broadcasting that, I was thinking you were doing it after this show, which typically by the time I'm done with this show, it's time to start cooking dinner or, you know, whatever. And a lot of times, like today, I flew in here this morning. We landed about, I think it was 6:30 in the morning. It's a long ride to the hotel. And then I just got working on stuff. I laid down for about an hour. So by this time of night, I'm ready to either go to bed or go get something to eat and then go to bed. But that's good. So I'll check you out, and maybe I'll call in one of these days on your show. And, of course, I know Paulo will probably be listening too. But thanks for calling in, Steve. Appreciate it.
And, thank you. You're doing a great job, and you're always welcome to call our show. Take care.
Okay.
Good to meet you.
Thanks, Steve. Bye now.
Likewise.
All right, Paul, any last-minute thoughts? Well, this show went long, but, hey, we had a good show. We had a great guest, and that's why I decided to extend the show a little bit in case we went over, and certainly we did.
Yes. Yes, we did, and it was good. It was worth it.
Yeah, definitely worth it. All right, well, we'll be broadcasting again tomorrow live from Sao Paulo, Brazil, and Boston, Massachusetts. We don't have any specific guests lined up for tomorrow. That's good because that'll give us a chance to pontificate and talk about things. So we'll talk about a little bit about cooking our favorite foods. We'll talk about a little bit about travel. And
well,
let's see, what else? Yeah. And then we'll talk about current events and what's in the news and that kind of things, and that'll give me a chance to do some more of my ranting on the Constitution and cutting our debt. You know, we keep talking about the deficit. It's killing me. I have a hard time reading the paper right now because everybody keeps talking about this deficit cutting. You know, not only cut the deficit, we've talked about this. All they're really doing is, yeah, we're going to cut deficit spending. We're just going to increase taxation spending.
Right.
But we're not doing anything to cut the debt. So it's like our politicians are telling us we want to keep government the same size, but we don't want to keep borrowing to keep it this size. So we're just going to take more of your money. That's the way it works. So a lot of people don't quite understand how that works. They think deficit is the same as debt. It's not. Deficit gets you into debt. But our politicians aren't talking about anything they're going to do to get us out of debt. And that is making me nervous. And that's precisely why Standard & Poor's gave a negative future rating to our AAA rating in the U.S. Treasury, because nobody's talking about cutting the debt. They're only talking about slowing the deficit spending, and raising taxes in an economy like this is not good for the economy either. So that's why we got it. It's precisely why we got it. It's real simple. You don't have to be an economist to know that stuff.
No.
Yeah. All right, Paula, well, you're probably ready for dinner. What are you cooking tonight? Are you cooking or are you going to go out?
I'm not sure if I'm going to make spaghetti with meat sauce or if we're just going to go over to the California Pizza Kitchen. We did go out to a really nice place last night, so.
Uh-huh, okay. Yeah, I went to a really nice place today and called the grocery store, and I got a roasted chicken. And
there you go.
Some brie and some bread and what else? Oh, gosh, I can't remember a couple of things. I didn't get any sweets or anything like that. But I had, so I got stuff to tide me over. And then I'm actually going to go out. There's some really nice, quaint little sort of sidewalk cafes where you get a little snack and get something to drink and that kind of thing. And it's a nice night out. So unless it rains, it doesn't look like it's going to. That's what I'm going to do, just kind of hang out. And but anyway, so if it's spaghetti and meatballs, enjoy. Otherwise, California Pizza Kitchen, that's pretty darn good too. So have a good night. Say hello to family for me, and we will be back in the air tomorrow at 4 o'clock.
Enjoy yourself, Tom.
All right, thanks.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to The American Hour with Commander Tom Garcia on the USA Talk Radio Network.